Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. Christianity is dying and Islam is on the rise. So says a new analysis of Britain's 2011 census, which finds that while the number of professing Christians in this country has fallen by 15%, the number of professing Muslims has surged by 75%. What's behind the figures? Does the change really matter? And what can be done about it? Are Britain's days as a majority Christian country numbered? I'm joined in the studio by Anglican Bishop Michael Nazir Ali and by Damien Thompson, editor of Telegraph Blogs and a former Telegraph religious correspondent. The 2011 UK census found that the decline of native British Christianity has been masked by the arrival of 1.2 million foreign-born Christians. Among the natives, Christian affiliation has fallen by 5.3 million in the past decade, and the proportion of young people calling themselves Christian has dropped below half for the first time. Meanwhile, Islam is going through a boom. Not only is the number of Islamic believers up by 75%, but it's a remarkably youthful faith too. Almost half of British Muslims are under 25. Of course, the number of Christians still far outstrips the number of Muslims, but the point stands that while one faith seems to be wilting, the other is in rude health. What do all these changes mean for Britain, and what can Christians do, if anything, to bolster their numbers? Starting first with the decline of Christianity, Bishop Michael, I'd like to ask if your personal experience of being Bishop of Rochester and your strong ties with Christians abroad bear out this picture of British Christian decline.
I think there are a number of questions about the census. I have suggested to the ONS, for instance, that if they're going to have a question about faith, it shouldn't be necessarily about religion, because the term religion has now very negative connotations in the culture, and especially among the young, because from school onwards they're told religion is the cause of evil, religion is not necessarily a good thing, etc., etc. And this has got deep into people's consciousness now. Equally, I think the spirituality is now the sort of fashionable word, and people claim to be spiritual even if they're not religious and so forth. However, I think it is true that Christianity in Britain has been declining since the 1950s, perhaps the 1960s, for a number of reasons.
Okay, before we get into that, so to clarify, there is a difference between people being part of the organized religion of Christianity and people expressing a faith in it. So there is some hope to be gleaned that while people might be saying, I don't go to church, do you think people still could feel innately Christian?
I'm not sure about Christian. I think there is an innate desire, longing to believe. I mean, we see this when traumatic events happen, like at Woolwich last week, where all the messages, for example, presuppose a spiritual reality, immortality of the person. I mean, things like that. Now, you may say these are vestigial, no doubt they are. But clearly, this is not secularism. Mm-hmm. This is not materialism. There is something still there.
Okay. So what then is behind the decline of people identifying concretely as Christian? What are the factors, do you think, that have caused that to happen?
I think there is a generalized suspicion about belonging to anything. And political parties suffer from that. Football clubs even suffer from it. And certainly the churches suffer from it. So there is an overly individual, I would call it, approach to life. More and more funerals now have Frank Sinatra's I Did It My Way as one of the kind of mandatory pieces of music. So I think it's that. That has been encouraged by a kind of worldview and an emphasis on autonomy in all sorts of ways, which is behind this.
Okay, how much of the responsibility for that comes from Christians themselves? I mean, is this just part of a general social trend that cannot be stopped, or could Christians have stepped in and prevented this from happening?
I think the churches have been complicit in what has been going on in culture since the 1960s. They have more or less capitulated to this individualistic, overly individualistic view of the human person. They have not emphasized the importance of human beings in relationship. They have, for example, capitulated on the family. I mean, the family is the first place where we experience human society.
But they would say, particularly liberal Anglican Christians, that they have placed an emphasis upon corporate responsibility. I mean, there's a strong trend within modern Anglicanism towards things like fair trade buying, towards social activism. There is certainly a social component to modern Christianity.
Yes, but again, at least domestically, the presuppositions of that are welfarism, that it is the state should deliver all these goods that we need, not on the family, for example. Not even on voluntary action in the local community, even though Christians are hugely involved in voluntary work. But there is somehow always this sense of demanding. I mean, we had this recently with the churches demanding the government that the government should reconsider what it was doing about welfare, for instance. Yes, there is a social conscience. That's not the same thing as supporting those relationships that are life-enhancing.
Okay. Damian Thompson, are we seeing a secularization of our society? And if so, what does that mean?
Yes, I think we're seeing profound secularization of our society on two levels. First of all, there's the broader secularization of society in which supernatural beliefs no longer mold public policy. They're reduced to the symbolic significance of rites of passage. What interests me is the internal secularization of the churches, to which Bishop Michael's already referred, in which supernatural beliefs are tacked on to what are essentially secular causes, human rights, concern for the environment. I think this is an easy option for the risk-averse middle managers who present company accepted, very much accepted, become bishops these days. I mean, turning children into climate ambassadors, which is one of the ambitions of the Catholic bishops of England and Wales, doesn't frighten the horses. And actually, it's much easier to do since society is pushing the churches and their members in the direction of that sort of secular campaigning anyway. And when children grow up, they can sort of unbolt the Christian interpretation of environmentalism, God's creation, whatever, at any time, and they'll hardly notice. I think it's interesting that Pope Francis has said this week that it is wrong to reduce Christianity to doing social good, but that seems to be, nonetheless, what it is being reduced to, with the results that we see in the decline in church attendance. Because if Christianity really is about being a climate ambassador, then why bother going to church?
Well, yes. Bishop Michael, this concept of being risk-averse as a Christian seems rather counterintuitive to what Christianity is all about.
Well, yes, I think that's partly because Christians in this part of the world haven't personal experience often of what it means to be a Christian where it's a risky thing to be a Christian. And that has to be learnt again. But I think it's more than just being risk-averse, to be honest. I think in terms of what Damian has just said, I think there is a long process of secularization which has taken place, which has removed the need in people to ask spiritual questions about themselves, about the world in which they live. This has to do with education, for instance. I mean, just to take one example, the secularization of time. We owe our notion of time to the Bible as a forward progressive movement which is open to change and development and indeed fulfillment. And in chronological time, as you know, ordinary sort of watch time or calendar time, the church had moments, days, even more than that sometimes, when you were taken out of yourselves into something transcendent. I mean, this for me is shown very clearly in how the word holy day has become holiday.
Right, right.
You know, that sort of element of transcendence has been taken out of time. It's also, science has made huge progress in asking the question about what things are. I mean, that's okay, because that was a responsibility given to Adam to identify things, the classification of things. But what has not been emphasized, is not emphasized in education, is the why of things.
Yeah. Of course, we presume, I mean, we are Christian, and we presume that that why matters. If Britain is becoming increasingly a minority Christian culture, then I suppose some people would say, well, for those who don't believe that there is a why, there is nothing beyond this, why does it matter that society doesn't take time for the transcendent anymore? I mean, what is wrong with simply getting on with life?
Well, it's not just the why. I think it's also the what for. And we are wired, we are innately sort of structured to ask questions about meaning and significance of ourselves and what is around us. What tends to happen is that if you don't have the Christian answer, then you manufacture answers for yourself, or you go into depression. I mean, the proportion of people now who experience depression is huge. You know, you ask any doctor about that.
Or possibly you trend towards extremism.
Yes, you can. I mean, you can turn to ideological extremism, whether that's Marxist or Islamist. I think that's certainly possible. Before we get to that, I think what I find as I go around the world and compare cultures is the dying, I hope that's not too strong a word, but the dying of the spiritual sense very often in people because of the long drawn out process of secularization. So when I go to other countries in Africa or Asia or wherever it may be, whatever people's faith, there is a sense in them that they are spiritual beings. Now, once you kill that, then, of course, it becomes doubly difficult, very difficult, to ask those what for questions, those why questions, those questions about transcendence. I think that has to some extent happened in this country, even with people who go to church.
Damien.
I'm interested in comparing Christianity in that respect to Islam. Christianity is really rather a complex system of belief. The relationship between Jesus and God the Father is hard to explain. The question of how you're saved is the source of continuing dispute. Islam, particularly in its more puritanical and well-funded expressions, is in many ways simpler. It has this relatively pure concept of God, and it offers salvation through detailed and easy to grasp, if not easy to follow, rules, memorizing scripture, giving to charity, abstaining from alcohol. But also, and this is one way in which I think it fits very well with the modern world, is it offers an outlet for anger, since the fastest-growing expressions of Islam stigmatize non-believers in a way that's not fashionable in Christianity anymore. So the religious anger in response to political grievances, of which there's an enormous amount, is sanctified, and I'm not just talking about the extreme gruesome violence of Woolwich, which is thoroughly unrepresentative of Islam, but I am looking at the mass demonstrations throughout the Muslim world in which the demonstration has become one of the major expressions of faith. That seems to me very worrying, because one of my concerns is that Christian churches in the West are turning a blind eye to the radicalization which in many ways is inherent to fundamentalist Islam?
So many questions here. I mean, I don't know which one to start with. Let's start with demonstrations. Last week, there was a huge demonstration in Paris about marriage. The media, including the Telegraph, if I may say so, gave it the minimal coverage possible. Pope Benedict, when he went to Spain last year, the press in the West was all about how there was to be a gay demonstration against him and how people would kiss each other in public in front of him and so forth, when in fact there was a demonstration of about 150 people and two of them kissed one another. But what was not reported at all was that he met with a million young people in Spain. Now, Pope Francis is going to Brazil, and again, all sorts of things have been said about him. But the fact that he's going to meet with 2 million young people has not been recorded at all. So which demonstration do you know?
I suppose Damien would reply, if you don't mind, that the nature of the demonstrations that he's talking about are very different from those Christian demonstrations.
Yes, but why do we notice the one kind and not the other?
Well, because the demonstrations in the Arab world have a political consequence. Am I interpreting what
Absolutely,
you're saying correctly?
Yes.
That when you see those massive demonstrations, it actually has ramifications not just for the Muslim communities, but also for the minority Christian communities, particularly in the case of Egypt. Whereas what you're describing, although certainly worthy of reporting, have less social consequence.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I think they may have less destructive social consequences, but they certainly should have, and I hope will have, social consequences. However, if I may go on to some of the other things that Damien has said, if I can remember them. I mean, Islam only appears to be simple. It's actually, if you really follow the Sharia, it's a fearfully complex business, and you are never assured that you've actually done what is all that is required of you. I mean, I have close relatives who have been doing it for years, and I follow to some extent what they're trying to do. Secondly, Christianity and Islam are not just faiths in the kind of emasculated sense that the media talk about and the politicians talk about faith. They are worldviews. And if they are a worldview, then you have to talk about the world and human life as it really is. If it is complex, so be it. So a kind of false simplicity, whether it is of kind of fundamentalist evangelicals in the U.S. or Christian evangelical fundamentalists in the U.S. or Islamist fundamentalists. That's not necessarily true. I think we've got to get that message across. It may make an easy headline, but it doesn't necessarily make for truthfulness.
But if you don't mind, the simplicity of fundamentalism obviously does appeal to some personality types. I mean, if we take Woolwich, one of the attackers, alleged attackers was, I believe, a convert from Christianity to fundamentalist Islam. So even if, of course, the vast majority of the faith do live with that complexity, and as you say, do have their own conscience they constantly have to test, there is something about a wing, a dimension of Islam, which does appeal to angry young people.
Well, indeed, and some of it is fed by the educational system here. If you teach people, black people from Africa or the Caribbean, that slavery was perpetrated on them by England and the whites in the United States, for instance, I mean, that's the kind of narrative they've heard and been taught. They are then given a narrative that Islam is the great liberator from slavery, without mentioning that the Arab slave traders were on the east coast of Africa and indeed in West Africa before the British and the Americans, and that the British and the Americans were just piggybacking, if that's not inappropriate, on what the Arab slave traders were doing. I mean, if you are sold all of these things, if you're never told about how in the attempt to end the slave trade and to end slavery itself, those evangelicals from this country particularly who were doing this were opposed by the Arab slave traders. I have walked along the path that Livingston took. And as churches were built along the path that he took, the Arab slave traders were burning them down. I mean, I've been on those sites myself.
And could I ask, you know, do Arab slave traders feature in history lessons in Britain, as far as you know?
I doubt it.
So you're saying that a consequence of politically correct educational system is that we fail to educate people about the realities of faith, and that can assist radicalization, or the realities of history?
We have certainly not taught our young people for the last 50 years the perfectly virtuous pages, as Leckie called them, of the history of this country. Now, there are lots of pages that are not perfectly virtuous, and of course we should teach young people about those events as well. But to ignore what really happened and to give a lopsided view of history in the interests of political correctness or, before then, Marxist ideology even, well, you can't then blame young people if they turn to something else that has a less critical view of itself.
I wonder if you could think of any other examples. You've mentioned the slave trade, but any other examples of political correctness that are skewing young people's vision of their culture and the role of Christianity in their culture?
Well, I think the whole approach to religious education, for instance, where I have described it as this kind of smorgasbord approach, where, you know, you set out all these wares, all sorts of exotic things that people can taste and experience, but you don't give them a vantage point from which to assess what they're experiencing and studying. Now, it would have been quite possible to have taken the Christian faith as a point of departure for studying people of other faiths and other cultures in a constructive, open way, but this has not been done. And so you can't blame young people for growing up without any kind of orientation. I mean, they lack a way of assessing what is true and what isn't. All they've got is phenomenology.
But it's very difficult in a multicultural society to justify teaching other religions as comparative studies.
I don't see why. I mean, what is a multicultural society anyway?
What I infer from what you're saying is that, for example, Muslim or Hindu children should be taught that this is a Christian country. There is some fundamental historical truth to Christianity, and now let's look at how that compares to Buddhism and Hinduism and Islam. Now, that's obviously that's going to be deeply insensitive to the parents of those children who don't share the Christian faith.
Actually, Tim, I have to disagree with the premise of your question. I think what the bishop is saying is that we're recognizing the Christian roots of this country and putting Christianity in its important and large perspective in our island story, if you like. I don't think the bishop is saying that the doctrinal truths of Christianity need to be forced onto people who belong to other religions. That's not what he's saying at all, I don't think.
But there are two things I'm saying. I mean, one certainly, that is why I said, what is a multicultural society? At least formally, Britain remains a Christian society. You've only got to read the coronation service to see how Christian. But of course, I don't mean Christian in any kind of closed and exclusive way, but Christian as a worldview that allows people then to take account of whatever else they experience. That certainly will be other faiths and how they make sense of the world. People of other faiths, Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, are welcome to contribute to this discussion. I mean, this is a discussion. It is not simply, as Damien has just said, forcing what we believe onto other people. The second thing about this is the assumption that there is some kind of secular neutrality which can then replace Christianity. Well, there is no such thing as secular neutrality. Secularism has its own presuppositions. It is its own way of looking at the world. It is its own worldview. And one of the things we have to set aside is this lie, I think, that we've been sold now for many years, that secularity is some kind of tabula rasa from which all of us can make a beginning.
Indeed.
It isn't.
Indeed. What also strikes me is the lack of intellectual self-confidence among Christian leaders.
Yes.
I cannot remember anything particularly memorable said by Rowan Williams, like expressing his faith or evangelizing, though I can certainly remember his remarks about Sharia. I can't remember a single interesting thing that Archbishop Vincent Nichols has ever said, and I suppose that sounds rude, but it happens to be the case. There seems to be a tremendous lack of the sort of leadership at the top of Christianity that you would find at the top of every other area of human activity. And I'm wondering if Bishop Michael found, when he was senior diocesan bishop, that there was a lack of interest in the questions he was raising, the questions about failure to promulgate the Christian faith, lack of cultural self-confidence, when you talk to your fellow bishops or people from other Christian faiths.
Yes, I think what how people excuse this is by saying this is about engagement. So we must understand the language of secularity, for instance, in order then to make the Christian faith intelligible to such people. And I think there is something in this. However, what can then happen is that the language of secularity, in fact, takes over. So instead of engagement, you've got capitulation. I mean, this is constantly happening now in the Christian churches, that the Christian worldview simply capitulating to a secular worldview. There are many examples of this. What we have is a secular worldview which works in the area of policy, for instance, and even legislation on a kind of default utilitarianism, or even worse, on things like focus groups and polling. So the transcendental values that a Christian leader should be actually talking about are never mentioned. For instance, if you are talking about the special status of the human embryo, let's mention that, because for 6 years I was the chair of the Ethics and Law Committee of the HFEA. And the original HFE Act recognized the special status of the human embryo. Now, on what is that based? It can be based on nothing else but the Judeo-Christian belief that human beings are made in God's image, and therefore the human embryo is not just like any other piece of human tissue or indeed animal tissue. It deserves respect. But if you go down that route, then you have to ask what sort of respect and how far does that respect extend? Can the embryo ever be used, ever be manipulated in a way which is simply a means to some other ends? You know, all those questions immediately arise about. But if you are simply doing polling and if you're simply doing focus groups, then if the focus groups and the polling reveal, for instance, as they did, revulsion about manipulation of the human embryo, then all the publicity people do is to work on public opinion, and lo and behold, in 5 years' time, is in a different place.
Well, as we've reached politics, let's conclude with one final question about politics. Tony Blair was famously told, "We don't do Christianity," and it was discouraged. David Cameron has talked about his own faith as coming and going, like listening to Magic FM. Do you think David Cameron has done enough to support Christianity in this country?
Well, it's not a matter of personalities, but what I say to politicians of any kind, of whatever party, you mentioned Tony Blair and David Cameron, and I've certainly said this to both of them personally, is that the Christian faith is much more, it is much more important than privilege for any particular church. You know, let's put that to one side for the time being. We need the Christian faith for making moral decisions in the public place, in terms of public policy, in terms of legislation. I mentioned the human embryo. You could equally say that about legislation dealing with mental capacity. You can say that about assisted dying. You can say that about how to support the family. There are so many things that come up for policymaking and legislation where you need a moral and spiritual tradition. Now, Britain has such a moral and spiritual tradition. Secularism has not actually provided any replacement for it. And if we don't use it, then we are victim to polling and focus groups and default utilitarianism.
Indeed, but if I could just ask you, do you feel that the guardians of this spiritual and ethical tradition are doing enough, by which I mean the leaders of the churches?
Well, the churches themselves, I mean, you know, people get a leadership they deserve, so it's not just the leaders. I think the churches have generally capitulated to secular culture. And therefore cannot bring a distinctive voice to bring a distinctive voice to public debate,
with results that we see in the census.
Bishop Michael and Damian Thompson, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.